from WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Michelle Martin in for Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. It's easy to forget now, but before 9/11 and all that came later, George W. Bush set out to be the education president. That's why in January of 2002, he signed the No Child Left Behind Act into law. Here's the then president talking to students at Hamilton High School about what he hoped to accomplish.
From this day forward, all students will have a better chance to learn, to excel, and to live out their dreams.
The goal, as the president made clear, was to make sure that schools across the country were held accountable for all children, especially those from low-income families or with disabilities. But the results have come with a price that critics say is too high. More testing, less flexibility, and some say a punitive, joyless atmosphere in schools. This week, the Senate has taken up a bill to replace No Child Left Behind. The new bill would keep testing in place, but take away control of what to do about the results from the federal government. This hour, On Point, a new direction for education. You can join us on air or online. What has No Child Left Behind meant for your school? Are you ready for something new? We'd particularly like to hear from principals, teachers, parents who've had to deal with the effects of the policy directly, and of course, students. Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at onpointradio. Now, we'd like to hear about the debate going on right now in Washington, D.C. from Lindsay Layton, who covers education for The Washington Post. Lindsay, thanks so much for joining us.
Hi, Michelle. Thanks for having me.
So what's the proposal being taken up by the Senate? They started the debate yesterday, as I understand it.
That's right. And they continue today. And actually later today, the House will also take up its version. So we've got dueling ideas going on in each chamber. And so the focus this week is really education, education.
Tell us about the bills in turn, if you would. Tell us about the Senate bill, because that's the one that's gotten a lot of attention, I think, mainly because of the fact that it passed unanimously out of the committee, which seems very unusual in these polarized times. Tell us about the key points.
Sure. So the Senate bill, as you say, it's bipartisan. It's Lamar Alexander of Tennessee and Patty Murray of Washington State worked together. And it took quite a lot of negotiation over many, many months, but they were determined to get a bill that both of their parties could agree to, just to get it to the floor, to get it this far. So the bill, basically what it does is it shifts power from the federal government back to states and local school districts. And there are a lot of prohibitions that are written into this bill that really put handcuffs on the federal government. The feds under this legislation would not be able to influence state academic standards. They wouldn't be able to push the Common Core and other or any other state standards that have been quite controversial. The feds would not be able to judge whether schools are failing or succeeding. They wouldn't be able to require that teachers be evaluated. They wouldn't be able to impose any particular school improvement strategy, which is a big one. That's what a lot of the districts and the states have been rebelling against under No Child Left Behind. And they also wouldn't be able to mandate which schools need improvement. So all these decisions are turned back to states and local districts.
But the testing regimen, which is the thing that you hear most people complain about, that stays in place. Am I right about that?
It does. It does. Currently, under No Child Left Behind, every kid is tested in grades 3 through 8 in math and reading once a year and once in high school. And then science, their science test 3 times during a child's schooling. So that stays in place. That's true. But the whole federal accountability structure that was built around that through No Child Left Behind, you know, the federal government's ability to look at a school and say, you're failing because your kids aren't meeting this particular score. And as a result, you've got to do A, B, and C. That all washes away. So, in other words, the stakes attached to these standardized tests come down some, which is a great relief to many teachers and many school superintendents and many state, you know, education commissioners.
How does the funding or does the funding change? Because I think that first under No Child Left Behind, and the thing that stands out for many people, and later, of course, the Obama administration has its own version of this, but it still kind of sticks and carrots. Sticks first. If you don't do this, supposedly you get money taken away. And then under the Obama administration, the iteration is if you do these things, we'll give you money. How does this change that? How does the money, federal money, get apportioned under this new policy if it's adopted?
So basically the states, again, they'll have much more control over their federal dollars. They'll be able to decide how to use them. Currently, you know, under current law and under the Obama administration's policies, it's been a lot more prescriptive. If you miss some mark, then you don't get to control some portion of the dollars that are spent on, you know, educating poor kids, for example. So that all washes away as well. So the states have a good deal more flexibility. However, in the House, that's really where there's a proposal to significantly change the way funds are used. And that has been very controversial, and that has actually triggered a veto threat from the president. The president does not like the Republican House bill and the way it proposes to change funding. So that's sort of a separate issue.
Can you describe that for us, though? Because I did want to hear about the House bill and what distinguishes it from the Senate bill. What does the House bill do that's different, and why did that trigger the veto threat?
So the House bill has this thing called portability, which is a very wonky term, but it's actually very important to the way schools are able to use funds and function. The federal government pays a certain amount of money every year to schools to help them educate poor kids, basically. It's called Title I funds, and this is very important to school budgets. Under the proposal by the House Republicans, the money that goes to states to educate poor kids would follow the child. So if you've got a low-income child who transfers to a wealthy school, the money that would go to that child goes with him or her to the wealthier school, whether or not that school needs the funds. The Obama administration says this is a slippery slope. It's the first step towards private school vouchers. We don't support this, and it would devastate high poverty schools that really need those resources. So the Democrats say that's a non-starter, and the president has threatened a veto.
What is the administration's posture, the Obama administration's posture toward the Senate bill? Does it look like there is some interest there? Because even though it does curtail the federal government, at least the education department's role in determining the direction that schools can go in.
Sure. The White House, while the president has said, you know, they don't like the GOP bill out of the House, they'll veto it. The Senate, their position on the Senate bill is a little more nuanced. They say they don't like it in its current form. What their beef with the Senate bill is that there's no real requirement in that bill for states to take action when schools are repeatedly failing. And there's also no identification in that bill of no definition of what makes a failing school. So the White House and the Democrats are concerned, and also civil rights groups and also the business community, they're concerned that there's not enough federal accountability in that Senate bill. When schools are failing and they're not graduating a large chunk of their kids from high school, they want states to be compelled to do something about it, not just, you know, report the data, but to actually take action. So that's the White House's beef with the Senate bill.
Well, Lindsay, thanks so much for taking time away from covering the bill. And I know you're still in the thick of covering it. But before we let you go, what's the tone of the conversation around this bill? As I said, we hear so much from Washington. What we hear is a lot of, you know, partisan division. We hear a lot of intense disagreement, increasingly in recent years. What's been the tenor of this discussion so far?
Well, it's interesting, Michelle. It's in the Senate, they spent the opening day really congratulating each other for coming to agreement and actually getting legislation to the floor. Now, remember, you mentioned this at the outset, this bill is 8 years overdue. So they spent a lot of time just applauding themselves for actually coming to some agreement enough to get the bill to the floor. They've still got a long way to go, right? They've got to pass it. The House has to pass something. They have to come together and compromise, and then the president has to sign off. So there's there's still a long road ahead, but it's an indicator of how gridlock we've been here, that they were just applauding and celebrating the fact that they got something to the discussion point. So it'll be interesting to watch how it goes forward from here.
Lindsay Layton writes about education for The Washington Post. She was kind enough to speak with us from Washington, D.C. Lindsay, thanks so much for speaking with us.
Oh, thanks for having me, Michelle.
For the rest of this hour, we're going to dig into some of the deeper issues behind the movement to replace or revise No Child Left Behind. We're going to hear from Katie Haycock, who's president of the Education Trust. That's an education advocacy organization focused on reducing the achievement gap for low-income and minority students. Katie, we don't have a lot of time before we need to take our first break, but welcome. Thank you so much for joining us.
Hi, Michelle. Thanks for asking me.
And of course, you're going to stay with us. But before we take our short break, can you just tell us, you were telling us before that No Child Left Behind really wasn't an education bill, but a civil rights bill. Tell us about that.
And that's been true, frankly, of every iteration of the Elementary and Secondary Education Act. It's important to remember that the initial ESEA was signed by Lyndon Johnson and was a part of the War on Poverty. The goal then remains the goal today, and that is to provide extra resources to schools that serve concentrations of low-income children, children of color, children with disabilities, and English learners to help those schools improve the outcomes for those children.
Well, very briefly, Katie, you know, we're going to hear a lot about what No Child Left Behind got wrong, but did it get anything right?
Absolutely. And we don't talk about that very much, but the reality is that it fundamentally redefined what it means to be a good school in America. No longer was it okay to have a high overall average, but have very low performance for some groups of kids. In order to be a good school, you had to be improving achievement for all groups of kids that you served.
This is On Point. I'm Michelle Martin, in for Tom Ashbrook. We're talking about a new bill in the Senate that would overhaul No Child Left Behind. We're talking with Katie Haycock, president of the Education Trust. That's an advocacy organization focused on reducing the achievement gap for low-income and minority students. Katie, thanks so much for staying with us.
Happy to do so.
And joining us now from Chevy Chase, Maryland, is Chester Finn, Distinguished Senior Fellow and President Emeritus of the Thomas B. Fordham Institute. That's an education policy think tank. He's a founding partner of the Edison Project. That's a for-profit education management organization. He's a member of the Maryland State Board of Education and a former top aide to the Secretary of Education in the Reagan administration. Mr. Finn, thank you so much for joining us.
Yep. Nice to be with you.
So, Mr. Finn, I had asked Katie Haycock the question of whether No Child Left Behind did anything right, since we focused a lot in recent years on everything that went wrong or that critics think went wrong. I'd like to ask you that question. Did No Child Left Behind accomplish anything important in your view?
Yes. We know a whole lot more about school performance than we ever knew before, and we're a lot more conscious of how kids, including different groups of kids, are doing in their schools than we ever were before, and this is a good thing. I also think that we can probably track some of the modest gains in scores, mostly in math, mostly in the younger grades, to some of the effects of No Child Left Behind, though there have been a lot of other things going on at the same time.
So what's gone wrong with it in your view?
Well, there's been a huge amount of federal government overreach paralyzing a lot of state and local decision making by putting way too many mandates and requirements on them, and in the end, not having very many of those mandates and requirements work very well. All these interventions into low-performing schools, for example, have had very little success in turning around low-performing schools. And it's infuriated local superintendents and state legislators and a lot of teachers, and also caused them to believe that way too much emphasis was being placed on the test scores because everything hinged on the test scores.
And you don't buy that? You don't buy that there's too much testing?
Well, there's too much testing, but most of it's not actually a consequence of No Child Left Behind. The states and districts and individual schools have added a huge amount of testing of their own in many ways not required by the federal law. But there has been a test revolt. There's no question about that. And easing back, I think, on the high stakes uses of these tests, the consequences that follow from test scores, is part of what's going on in both the Senate and House bills. And for better and worse, I think that's a needed correction to a over-regulated, over-governed approach to what's really a very limited part of the education scene. Do keep in mind that the federal government's share of American school budgets is around 10 or 12% only.
Hmm. Katie Hancock, what about you? I didn't get a chance to ask you this question. What do you think? You identified things that you think that No Child Left Behind improved in terms of the country's education landscape, but what do you think has gone wrong? And when do you think it went off the rails in your point of, in your perspective?
Well, there's definitely lessons from NCLB. One of the most important is one that Checker actually mentioned, and there's agreement, frankly, from both the right and left on this, that there is a real risk in over-prescriptiveness, especially if the law is going to last 14 years. It's not supposed to, by the way, but it has. And so I think everybody agrees that there's a need to sort of right-size the federal-state relationship. But the important thing to remember here is right-size doesn't mean no size or no role for the federal government. Because if we've learned anything from the last 14 years, especially, frankly, not from the NCLB years, but from the NCLB waiver years, it is that states will do the absolute minimum that is required of them by the federal government, especially if that requirement affects low-income children, children of color, or other children who are marginalized in most states and communities. So if we actually want action, we need to expect it. Otherwise, we will indeed go back to what I would argue are the not-so-soft bigotry of low expectations.
I'd like to one of you made the point that there seems to be a lot of consensus around that something needs to change. In fact, the Congress did, in fact, allow No Child Left Behind to lapse 7 years ago, as you just pointed out. It just hasn't been reauthorized since. They haven't been able to come to agreement about what should replace it. I just want to play a short clip from President Obama in March of 2011, where he talked about his plans to try to reform No Child Left Behind. This is from a speech he made at Kenmore Middle School, which is in Arlington, Virginia.
We need not only hold failing schools accountable, we need to help turn those schools around. In the 21st century, it's not enough to leave no child behind. We need to help every child get ahead. We need to get every child on a path to academic excellence.
And here's Democratic Senator from Washington State, Patty Murray. This is in January, calling on the Senate to reform the No Child Left Behind Act. And she is one of the co-sponsors of the new bill. Here she is.
Mr. President, the current law, No Child Left Behind, is badly broken, and it is time to fix it. The good news is this doesn't have to be a partisan issue. Nearly everyone, Democrats, Republicans, teachers, parents, business leaders agree this law needs to be rewritten.
So, Katie, it may not be partisan, but is it ideological? Like, what are the real points of difference about what needs to happen here?
Well, there are a variety of points of difference in the House, but you asked specifically about the Senate. And the remaining major point of difference is whether schools that consistently perform at low levels for their students, or where any group of kids is not making progress, should be expected to act on that problem. With the current bill in front of the Senate does not include that expectation of action. And so the groups that you referenced before, civil rights organizations, disabilities organizations, and business have come together to ask the Senate to include that expectation of action. That is, when any school consistently performs at low levels, graduates few of its students, or allows any group of children not to make progress, that there be an expectation that in return for the $15 billion in taxpayer money they receive every year, they should actually be expected to do something differently.
Justin, how do you see it? How do you see the points of difference?
Well, the fact that the Senate Education Committee was able to be unanimous on this bill reflects the kind of delicate balance that was achieved in the committee, partly by fending off and really deferring to the Senate floor all the truly controversial amendments, which are going to flow today and tomorrow, and as long as it's on the floor, some of which I think are probably deal breakers or even poison pills that could cause the whole thing to fail and the reauthorization to stop. I think on this particular point, I believe the Senate bill, as I read it, does include the expectation that something will be done about these schools, but it does not, in fact, include the requirement that something be done about these schools, much less prescribing what should be done, which is, of course, what No Child Left Behind tried to do without very great success. So I think the big difference here is the extent to which the federal government should go beyond requiring data, outcomes, results, transparency, if you will, from the states, and should go on to tell them what they must do on the basis of those results. And it's pretty clear that the Republicans think that nothing further should be required beyond transparency. And the states are in charge. They run the schools. They put up most of the money. And that on the other side, there is, of course, a wish that the federal requirements would continue to essentially tell the states that they must take certain steps.
Mr. Finn, I'm curious about your opinion about this. I'm particularly interested in this because your forthcoming book is Failing Our Brightest Kids, The Global Challenge of Educating High-Ability Students. Just noting the fact, I highlight global, noting the fact that our students are going to compete in a global economy and in a much smaller world than even just a few years ago. And you know, internationally, I think, as most people know, American students don't perform as well as they could for many compared to another country. You know, kids from peer economies, and I'm just interested in this whole question of, you know, philosophically, do you believe that there should be some kind of national standards about what kids should be expected to know at different stages of their educations? I mean, how do you feel about that? How do you see that issue?
Well, first of all, thanks for flagging the book, which will be out in September, which is really mostly about gifted education, high-ability students. I think that we have to face the fact that we do not have a national primary and secondary education system in this country. We have a state-based primary and secondary education system, which the federal government has supplemented in various ways over the last 50 or 60 years. Many of them useful and necessary, like calling attention to children with disabilities and obviously desegregating the schools. But we still have 50 state education systems in this country, and all of them need to up their game. We've got just a few states that are really performing at international levels, and most of the rest need to do a whole lot better. But the federal government isn't running them and can't make them up their game. It really has very limited leverage, and it needs to trust them to use these results. And there are all kinds of measures, not just the federal required tests, but international measures like the PISA tests and so on, national assessment measures, needs to trust them to use these results to improve what they do.
But why can't it make them up their game, though? I don't understand.
Well, it doesn't. Prescribe standards. It doesn't hire teachers. It doesn't set graduation requirements. It doesn't set class sizes. And it only contributes 10 or 12 cents of the dollar on the education budget. So it really doesn't run the schools.
Well, I'd love to, Kate, I really want to get to some callers, but Katie, can I just get your perspective on that? Can the federal government get the states to up their game or not?
Absolutely, and it must. The reality is we have seen this dance before. In the 1990s, we left all of this to states. Congress asked them to set their own goals, their own define progress in their own way, and to measure the progress of low-income children and children of color. Sorry, and the reality is they didn't do any of those things. Most of them defined progress as not falling backward very far. Achievement during those years remained flat. The gaps between groups started growing again. So as to trusting states, I would argue that in this domain, that is, the domain that affects the education of the most marginalized children, we cannot afford to simply trust states, to hand over $15 billion and say, do whatever you want, because we've seen before what happens when you do that, and we can't afford it as a country.
Let's hear from some of the listeners on this. A number of people want to participate in our conversation. Let's hear from Mason, who's calling from Monroe, North Carolina. Mason, how are you? What's on your mind?
Hello, Michelle. As someone who was in the school system here in North Carolina during, for a large part, No Child Left Behind, I graduated in 2010 high school and then went on to graduate college. It seems to me that the problem, as many people have said in the past, is with the testing. I was fortunate in that I was always, the way that I learned lent itself very well to a multiple choice standardized test question format. I had friends, I knew others, who did not have that. That was not the way they learned. That was not the best way that they tested. And so you run into the problem, I feel, that the type of tests that we are giving to our students simply does not measure their aptitude or their knowledge. The problem being that the tests must be standardized, and the students are not.
Okay. Thank you, Mason. Thanks so much for calling. How about Brendan, who's calling from Belchertown, Mass? Did I say that properly?
Yes. Hi, Michelle.
Okay, Brendan, what's your perspective on this?
Well, I was a career changer. I taught for 10 years in an urban school, middle school, mostly math, and you know, No Child Left Behind came empty. Every one of us said, if there's no money, you're going to leave, you know, busloads of kids are going to be left behind. You need to interject a larger number of teachers. You need to improve the profession. You have to pay the teachers more and give them time to be themselves. Many of these teachers now are burdened with self-evaluations and so on that take up time. And many of these teachers are women who are heads of households, and many of them are single parents. You cannot continue to overwork the teachers, put your thumb on them as the way to push better results. We need more teachers, more teacher input, a better quality of life and pay for teachers. We need security in their professions. Too many times, you know, the principals love the young and cute ones, and they get old and we get tired of them. They don't look so pretty anymore, and they're gone. You need to protect the unions. You need to protect the teachers.
That's a long list there, Brenda.
And encourage them to do a good job.
All right, Brenda, thank you so much that you gave us a long list of things there. To I want to focus on one thing, though, and I want to ask Mr. Finder, and perhaps Katie Haycock, you may know this. Brendan just said that No Child Left Behind didn't come with any money. That's not my understanding. Can somebody clarify that for me? I thought it, in fact, did come with money for the schools.
It does,
Katie?
Indeed. Katie? They're about $15 billion in Title I that go to schools serving concentrations of poor children. And that's hits about 95% of the school districts in the country. On top of that, there's another $1.5 billion in what's called Title II, which is intended to be professional development and other support for teachers.
Mr. Finn, do you have the same understanding?
Well, yeah, the money is there and isn't going to go down, incidentally, under the Senate bill, though I don't think it's going to go up either. But it continues to be in this, even if you add other things like special education, it's still in the 10 to 12% range. And I don't know anybody who realistically thinks that there's going to be a huge increase in federal spending on K-12 education. Most of the money comes from states and districts like Belchertown, Massachusetts.
Hi, everybody. Tom here. I'm glad you're joining us for this On Point podcast. Before we get back to the show, I'd like to tell you about another podcast you might enjoy, too, Dear Sugar Radio. Join hosts Cheryl Strayed and Steve Almond as they field questions about love, sex, work, guilt, money, you name it. That's Dear Sugar Radio. You can find it at wbur.org/Dear Sugar or subscribe on iTunes.
This is On Point. I'm Michelle Martin, in for Tom Ashbrook. We're talking about a new Senate bill that would replace No Child Left Behind. You can join the conversation. Have you lost faith in public education, in the government's ability to address the problems? We are continuing our conversation with Katie Haycock, president of the Education Trust, an education advocacy organization focused on reducing the achievement gap for low-income and minority students. Also with us, Chester Finn, distinguished senior fellow and president emeritus of the Thomas B. Fordham Institute. That's an education policy think tank. He's also a former top aide to the Secretary of Education during the Reagan administration. Thank you both so much for staying with us. You know, I want to focus on something that's a little, I don't know what's the word, amorphous, if you will. And I just want to play a short clip from an interview from Take Part. That's a motion picture studio that focuses on social justice. And this is an interview with a little boy called Zion, who's in fifth grade, who talks about his feelings about taking tests.
I get up in the morning and be like, oh, I have testing. And then I eat breakfast, still kind of depressed I have testing, and then go to school. I just hope I do good.
The reason I raise that is that we've been getting a lot of communications from listeners on Facebook and Twitter and all the other means that, you know, I've told you about, where people talk about just kind of a joylessness to school these days. For example, here's one from Amy Peterson, who came to us from Facebook and says, she says, I'd like to see an end to achievement testing. It's teaching to the test, period. I'd like to bring back the idea that education is for the purpose of teaching critical thinking and not for the purpose of making employable, productive members of society. The purpose of education is to enlighten, not train. And then we have other listeners who've written in and say similar things, that the atmosphere in schools, particularly these are teachers writing to us, to say it just feels that there's no joy in the classroom anymore. And I'd like to ask both of you, Chester Finn, maybe you want to start, if you feel that way.
It's a problem, but it's a solvable problem. The solution is not to do away with all forms of achievement measurement. I mean, you wouldn't take a thermometer away from a doctor or a blood pressure gauge or a cholesterol gauge. You need measures of whether anybody's learning anything. And testing is one such measure. It's not the only one. And there are good tests and bad tests. I mean, they're really dumb tests, and they're pretty creative tests. The latter, of course, are more expensive to administer and to score and bring various other issues with them. But it's really up to the people running schools, principals and teachers and local authorities to have lively curricula, well-prepared, knowledgeable teachers, great discussions, and enough technology also to give kids a chance to explore stuff. And doing away with testing will not make schools joyful. Great teachers will.
Will this new bill help this problem?
It'll take some of the pressure off the teachers and the schools to put as much emphasis as they've been putting on the tests, because the test results won't be forced back on them with these interventions unless their district or state decides to do so. And that's a debatable point, but I think that the idea is to ease some of the pressures on teachers and kids to just prepare for the tests. You heard an earlier caller, a teacher, talk about the way the teachers don't like the tests. And I don't think the job here of the federal government is just to cater to what teachers want or what kids want. But it certainly is to enable people running schools to run the liveliest, most interesting and exciting classrooms that they can.
Katie Haycock, what do you say about that?
You know, the thing we haven't talked about yet is that both the Senate and the House bills continue the requirement for annual assessment, that is, once a year. But they also take the pressure off those tests, not just in the way that Chester mentioned, but also by encouraging, in fact, even requiring states to include in their school rating systems more than just tests. So under No Child Left Behind, the only things that really mattered were tests, graduation rate, and in the case of elementary schools, actual attendance. Now schools and states are encouraged to broaden the measures there. So they might have other performance tests. They might have, at a high school level, for example, Are kids taking and completing a full college prep curriculum? Are they completing industry certifications? Are they completing and passing AP classes? And that sort of broader set of measures will, I think, both take some of the pressure off tests, but also give parents and others a sort of broader array of measures to evaluate and make choices about schools.
Well, so you feel that the Senate bill would be an improvement, and it would address this. It's hard to define, isn't it? You know but people know it when they see it, as like a sense of joy, kids really wanting to be in school, really understanding and embracing what it is that they're learning. And you think it kind of offers more of the opportunity for that to happen. But Katie, as I hear it, what you're saying, your main concern is that there's nothing driving schools to be accountable, particularly to the most vulnerable students, the students
yes.
with the least visibility. Is that what I hear you say?
Yes. And let's remember, one test a year is not a huge problem. It's all this proliferation of other tests that I would argue has driven the joy out, not these annual tests. And remember, our kids are going to have to take tests the rest of their life. They have to take tests to get into college. They have to take tests to avoid remediation. They have to take tests often to get out of college, to get into a job, to get promoted in their jobs, to get into the military. So just wiping those out and pretending that things will get joyful and rigorous simultaneously just defies imagination.
Chesterfin, could I get you to address Katie Haycock's point briefly, particularly about the most vulnerable kids? I certainly think we take your point here that the federal government's actual footprint in education at like 10 cents on the dollar is not sufficient to really compel these changes, and also just the way that the system is set up. But who is going to decide then, and who is going to be the person, or what is going to determine whether the most vulnerable children, the children from the least resourced families, the children with the most needs, do get the attention that they need and are held to standards, that they get the kinds of things that would allow them to perform to excellence?
Well, if I thought that 14 years of No Child Left Behind had solved that problem, I might have a different answer for you right now. But
good point.
But it really hasn't. The Senate bill, at least, will continue to require that not just the annual testing in reading and math, but also that the results be broken down by group of kids in each school and reported publicly. So we will know for each school in the country, at least in reading and math, how rich kids and poor kids and black kids and white kids and brown kids and disabled kids and boys and girls are doing separately. And then it is the responsibility under the Senate bill of their school, their district, or their state to decide what to do about it and how to move resources and teachers and curriculum and so forth around to educate the kids who aren't getting very well educated. The information will be there. The dispute here is over on whose back is the obligation to try to do something with that information.
Let's hear from some more listeners. Anne is calling from Burlington, Vermont. Anne, what's on your mind?
Hi, Michelle. The population that's LD is roughly 15 to 17% of the population in general.
You mean learning disabled? Is that what you meant?
Learning disabled.
Learning
yes.
disabled. Okay.
These bills impacted more on that population than the rest of the population. My concern is that we are still shortchanging the learning disabled child. I think I've seen where they're sort of stamped proceed to the next year in school, where there has not been any understanding at the teaching level of their real dysfunction, because the specialists in teaching this population are few and far between. There was a wonderful school in the Burlington area that talked to this population, a high school environment that closed. These kids are being shortchanged, and unfortunately, the onus is on the poorer families who cannot afford to get the proper testing for this child, who cannot afford to get the proper remediation for this child. I don't see where we are addressing this significant underserved population.
And can I just ask you this? Are you saying that you believe that No Child Left Behind made this problem worse, or that it just didn't address it at all, in your view?
I don't see in my, I work with the LD kids in the high school. I don't, and I'm the mother of an LD child, and I'm the wife of an LD individual who is a pioneer in this area in jazz. I do not see any significant improvement in this population. I've had kids with LD come to me privately who go to the public schools because the parent found out that I had this ability to teach these children. And the child sat in my living room and said, I don't learn at school, I learn here because I had the training to teach this population, you know, these kids.
Thank you for your call. And Katie Haycock, this is your sweet spot.
Yeah.
Kids with learning disabilities as well as kids from low-income, low-resource backgrounds. What is your perception of this?
There is no question that the problem that the caller identified is a serious one, not just for students with learning disabilities, but the variety of disabilities that children bring with them to school. The reality, however, is that those children have made more progress over the last decade than have virtually any other group of children. Students with disabilities are achieving at levels that nobody ever thought were possible back before we expected them to do so, which is what changed with No Child Left Behind. So that is why the organizations representing the children and parents with disabilities are a part of this broad coalition of civil rights, disabilities, and business organizations that are saying, yes, we have to right-size the federal role here, and no, we should not tell schools what to do here, but we must expect them to act when any group of children, including children with learning disabilities, is not improving.
Let's hear from Katrina, who's calling from, is it Vinita, Oklahoma? Katrina?
Yes. Hi, Michelle.
Hi.
I was calling because my son was in the seventh grade. We lived in Nebraska. And he took the ACT test and got a 20 composite in the seventh grade, had a 24 in science. He's basically college ready in the seventh grade. I tried to make arrangements with the school to try and skip him a grade or get him some accelerated classes. They refused and told me that he needed to wait for the rest of the kids to catch up.
What do you think that means, or what do you think that means?
I feel like the No Child Left Behind has hurt my son because, I mean, I moved school districts to get out of that school because they had nothing for my son. All they were worried about is these test scores and making sure that the lower income, which I'm lower income, but the lower producing schools, you know, the students that are having difficulty, all of these kids, they were more worried about them than worried about the ones that were doing well, that are explorated and not doing anything for them because they said they don't have the funds. They don't have nothing. They can't put any money to it.
Well, thanks for calling.
Or anything.
I see what you're saying. Katrina, thanks so much for calling. Mr. Finn, what about that? Do you think that might be true, that there is such an emphasis on showing achievement that you want to kind of hold some of the higher testers back in a way just so you can make your scores look good? What do you think about that?
No Child Left Behind, we haven't talked about this yet, but one of the things No Child Left Behind didn't get right was it put a single achievement bar in, or told states they had to put a single achievement bar in defined as proficient. And then all the pressure on states for accountability was to get kids up to that bar, but there was really no pressure at all to continue with kids who were already over that bar. And so No Child Left Behind has, in fact, encouraged us to neglect high-achieving kids because the way the law was structured put all the emphasis on low-achieving kids.
Let's hear one more call. I think we have time for one more from Erica, who's calling from New Orleans, Louisiana. Erica, what's on your mind?
Hi there. I'm a teacher in New Orleans. I teach biology. Going on my fifth year, we have the EOC biology test every year. And I just wanted to kind of throw in a different point of view. For me, testing is actually extremely motivating. I know that might sound a little bit different, but it actually makes it so that I don't even want to miss work sometimes. Well, not some, you know, as much as any other person, because I just want to be sure that they are prepared and that they're ready. And I think that Sesame actually kind of brings this like weird unity between me and my students. What we really want to do as best we can. And I work at a Title I school where, you know, there's definitely a lot of issues with reading and, you know, all those other social issues that go on in those environments. And I think that it's just a good way to kind of get kids motivated. And it actually brings a lot of joy to my classroom whenever the test results come in and we have a successful year.
All right. Well, thanks for that perspective. We appreciate that. Thank you very much. We only just have a couple of minutes left, so I'd love to hear from each of you, Katie and Katie Haycock and Chester Finn. It's a terrible thing to ask people to predict. It's totally unfair, which is exactly where I'm going to do it. But Chester Finn, maybe I'll ask you to go first. Do you think that knowing what you know about all the different points of view, do you think that this might be the time that we finally get a new education policy in place? Do you think this is the year?
Well, we're closer than we've been in 14 years. Let's put it that way. And we really are, as Katie said earlier, 7 or 8 years late in getting to this point. And we should have solved some of these problems a lot sooner. We do, in fact, have a bill on the Senate floor, and we have one coming to the House floor. And there will almost certainly be something enacted in each chamber and a conference committee to follow.
All right. Well, thank you for that, Katie Haycock. I don't know if I have time to give you the last word. In fact, I don't think I do, but I gave you the first word. So I hope that that's a comfort to you. We'll keep talking about this. It's an important issue. Katie Haycock, president of the Education Trust, was with us. Also, Chester Finn, distinguished senior fellow and president emeritus of the Thomas B. Fordham Institute. Thank you both so much for speaking with us.
Thank you, Michelle.
You can continue the conversation and get the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org. And you can follow us on Twitter and find us on Facebook at On Point Radio. Coming up tomorrow, a fatal shooting in San Francisco by an undocumented man, a 7-time felon deported 5 times, has ignited an immigration debate. I'm Michelle Martin, in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.